every once.
Bill, we need to thank the people who provided us with challenges this morning after the sermon. If you haven't,
I'm actually about to do that. I do want to publicly thank Allison for her faithfulness, and especially Barbara and Susan for how they fill in so graciously and seamlessly when Allison is not here. And whoever chose this week to bring the things out of the table, if you have not been to the service yet, you may not understand how funny that is.
Ralph set an example by cutting his piece of cake in half.
I set an example by only getting one plate full at a time. I will also tell you, just in case you did not see it, this is also the week, it's not only the week in which gluttony was in the spotlight during the worship service, but it's also the week that Pringles has announced that they are now selling pecan pie flavored chips. The challenges just keep coming. The challenges just keep coming. And I do want to thank all of you for your patience and for your faithfulness. Let me try to orient you where we are. We are going through the Bible a little at a time. Last week or the week before, we talked about sloth, which means doing things slowly, maybe, and maybe that's a description of how we're doing this. We have had some weeks where we did 10 or 15 or 20 chapters at a time, and we've had some weeks where we've done one verse at a time. In any event, we are in 1 Kings. We have just finished with chapter 8. I want to remind you a little bit of what was in chapter 8 before we go on. Solomon has finished with the construction of the temple, and chapter 8 represents the final pieces to that. They brought the Ark of the Covenant up, it says, from the city of David to the temple, as if the temple was in another place. We talked about how the city of Jerusalem now would encompass both of those places, but at one time the main city was in one place, a valley, and then another hill where we would call it the Temple Mount. When the Ark of the Covenant was put in place, God's glory in the form of a cloud filled the temple. They then followed that with a dedication service, the central feature of which was Solomon's prayer. And Solomon prayed in so many different ways that God's name being in that place would mean that God would hear the prayers offered in that place or towards that place, by those who were his people or by those who were seeking him, whether they were his people or not. Very, very interesting prayer. And we focused on that last week. When all of that was over, in verse 62 and verse 63 of chapter 8, you see the sacrifice that they had. And remember from Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers that whenever sacrifice was made, a part of the sacrifice was part of the sacrifice was given as food to the ones who attended at the temple, the Levites and the priests. But the majority of that was eaten by the person making the sacrifice and by friends and family. And so in that spirit, there was a giant feast, and the feast was, as I understand it, what had been offered in sacrifice. So how many oxen? We're not talking about 22,000 hamburgers. We're talking about 22,000 animals from which hamburgers might be made. How many sheep? 120,000. You know, how many plates of mutton can you get from that? A big, big, big feast. At the end of that chapter, it says, verse 65, Solomon and with him all of Israel, go to the end of that line, celebrated the feast before the Lord for at least a week. Some translations say 1 week, some translations say 2 weeks. At the end of which, verse 66, he dismissed the people. And what did the people do? Mine said they bade farewell. Bade is a word that we perhaps don't use very much anymore. They said farewell to the king and went home. What does it say? Mine says joyful and happy of heart over all the goodness which the Lord had shown to his servant, I take that to be Solomon, and to his people Israel. And that's where we left off last week. Now, what was the centerpiece of what we looked at last week? Solomon's prayer. When this happens, hear the prayer of your people. When this happens, hear the prayer of your people. When foreigners come, hear the prayer of the foreigners. his prayer for God and how God would respond to his people in and through the temple. So verse 1 of chapter 9, when Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and everything else which Solomon wanted to do, how long did that take? How long did that take? If you go to chapter 9, verse 10, you get a clue. 20 years. I think it was 13 for one and 7 for the other, but I don't remember now which one was which. He built a royal palace, and he also built the temple. I think it's more accurate to say he had them built, because there was lots and lots of forced labor involved. But after he'd finished the building of the temple, after he'd finished the royal palace, and after he finished everything else, verse 2 says something happened. What happened?
The Lord
appeared to him. When was the first time God had appeared to him? Right after he became king. And remember, he came king under very shaky circumstances. There seemed to be a lot of palace intrigue around that. And God came in part verifying and affirming that Solomon was in the right place with the right instructions and the right tasks ahead of him. Now he comes back the second time. The Lord said to him, this is verse 3, I've heard your prayer. I've heard the entreaty which you placed before me. And he begins to respond to that prayer. I find this almost as interesting as the prayer itself. Is that within a very short period of time, directly from God, Solomon has a response. I consecrate this temple which you have built. I place my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there always. For your part, if you walk before me in innocence of heart and in honesty, like your father David, if you do everything that I command and keep my laws and my ordinances, I will make your royal throne secure over Israel forever. Just as I promised your father David when I said, and he begins to quote what David had said. Verse 6, but if you turn away from me, either you or your descendants, and instead of keeping my commandments and laws which I've laid down for you, if you go and serve other gods and worship them, then what will happen? Mine uses the word banish. I will banish Israel from the country. Yours says cut off. And I will disown this temple which I have consecrated for my name. And Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. And as for this once exalted temple, everyone who passes by will be appalled. And they will whistle. Does yours say whistle?
Yes. Scoff.
Yours says scoff. Mine says, I can see a... Something like that, maybe. They will... Scoff is more negative. Whistle, I think, is just... Goodness. They will whistle and say, why has the Lord treated this country and this temple like this? And the answer will be, what? Abandoned. Mine says deserted. The Lord their God who brought their ancestors out of Egypt and? Mine says they adopted other gods and? Worship them and serve them. That is why the Lord has brought all these disasters on them. Now that's all you get. It doesn't say how the conversation ended. It doesn't say anything else, because it goes on to something else right after that. Solomon has prayed one of the most worthy prayers you've ever seen. And God says, essentially, that was a good and honorable prayer, and I will honor every part of it as long as, and it becomes conditional. What's the condition? Follow my laws, follow my commandments, and what will happen? I will make your royal throne secure forever. I am setting you up. In order for it to work, you have to remember what we just said. What did God say? If you follow me, you and your descendants, I will make your throne secure forever. Was Solomon's throne secure forever? No. What does that tell you? He didn't do it. So now what are we watching for? We're watching for the report of the details on how he didn't do it. And in that spirit, things that follow this start to make sense. At the end of 20 years that it took Solomon to erect the two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, that's verse 10. Mine now has a parenthesis. Does yours have a parenthesis? Mine has a parenthesis, and it says, Hiram, king of Tyre, had provided Solomon with all the cedar wood, juniper wood, and gold that he wanted. Close parenthesis, comma, and the sentence that you started goes on. So let's just put the whole sentence together and leave out that little ellipse. My teachers taught me to call it an ellipse. Did your teachers teach you to call it that? Maybe not. At the end of 20 years that it took Solomon to erect the two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, King Solomon gave Hiram 20 towns in the territory of Galilee. What a generous gesture. Doesn't that sound like a generous gesture?
Towns.
Yours says cities, mine says towns, okay. But when Hiram came from Tyre to view the towns which Solomon had given him, what does it say?
He didn't think much of them.
Mine says he was not pleased. Yours says...
I just made that up. Yeah, he didn't think much of them.
Paraphrasing is okay.
They did not please him.
Mine says he was not pleased with them. He said, what kind of towns are these you've given me, brother? And to this day, they are known by a phrase that we don't understand because my footnote says nobody knows exactly what the connection is between these. Does your footnote say? Some of you who have footnotes and you're checking on me every moment. Does your footnote speak to this?
Yeah, mine says... Yeah.
It says Cabell Land, and I don't know what that means.
Sounds like good for nothing.
Good for nothing is what it says? Yeah. What would a town have to be like to be called good for nothing?
Have four people.
I will tell you, and I tell you this with great sadness, that 2 weekends ago or 3 weekends ago, one of the weekends we were not here, Barb and I took a little trip out over to West Virginia. We had gone to see one thing and ended up actually stopping and seeing something else. We got far enough out that we said we need to find a place to stay. So we used my iPhone, which actually works in the car. This is cool. I've not had this before. And we called ahead, and the hotels in White Sulphur Springs were ridiculous. We did not call the Greenbrier. We didn't even try. Those of you who saw my posting on Facebook that said, at the Greenbrier, that's all it means. We walked in, we took that picture, we walked out. Anyway, we found a place that was within our price range, a few miles beyond at Lewisburg. Except we found out from the place that if we took that room, it would be the last room, and that was the second motel we had checked at in Lewisburg because the first one was completely full. So when we got there, we said, what is it that has your hotel full? And you would think, well, people are coming to see the leaves, but that was the changing of the leaves was still 2 weeks away. This wasn't prime time yet. And they said, oh, tomorrow is a festival. They're going to block off the downtown. They're going to have all kinds of booths and food and musicians and all this kind of stuff. And all the stores will have special sales and this kind of thing. It's just going to be an all-day-long affair. We stayed another day in Lewisburg. You go to downtown Lewisburg, it's gorgeous. The downtown still functions just like it did. And it's got wonderful stores, wonderful cafes. And the people on the street were friendly and wonderful and all this. If you go to my hometown and you go downtown, it looks like bombs went off. I don't know that my town necessarily, the one I grew up in, is good for nothing now. But they have not done with it like Lewisburg. Hiram was expecting Lewisburg, and instead he got Mossy Creek. If you know what that means, you know where that is. Now, pause for a minute. What had God just said? You want to keep my blessings, you want to have these promises come true, what do you need to do? Follow my laws, right? What's one of those laws? What's one of those commandments? Treat people the way you'd want them treated. The way you would yourself want to be treated. Is he treating Hiram, who gave him all the cedar wood, juniper wood, and gold that he wanted? Gave him, it says, right?
Yeah.
Gave him. Is this the way you treated to give him 20 worthless, good-for-nothing towns? I don't think so. The decline has started. You need to see it that way. Yeah, my footnote doesn't tell me how much that is, but I have a feeling it's a lot. I think it was Hiram had sent. I don't think Hiram necessarily sent then. I doubt Hiram would have felt all that grateful. Okay? Yeah?
Mine says one talent is $29,085.
In their money or in our money? Well, it have to be in our money because they didn't have dollars. But yeah, okay. So maybe $1 million or $2 million, something like that.
Mine says $3,500,000.
And that Bible was published a few years ago.
Yeah, and that's why I just said in verse 14.
Yeah. Verse 15 starts another subject. What's the subject? Just in case you don't know, the words start out, this is the account of, and it tells you what the subject is. What's the subject? Forced labor. What's forced labor? Somebody forces you to work. Would you like to do this for me today? That's not necessarily forced labor. Do this for me today. With soldiers in the back to enforce it. That's forced labor. Okay? This is the account of the forced labor levied by King Solomon for building. For building what? Temple of the Lord. We've talked about that one. His own palace. We've talked about that one. What's the third one?
The Millo.
The Millo. Okay? It's not mellow. So this is not mellow yellow or something like that. This is the Millo, M-I-L-L-O. And the fortifications of Jerusalem. And Hazor, and Megiddo, and Gezer. And then it tells you a little bit about Gezer, or Gezer. I don't want to say Gezer, it sounds too much like me. But it tells you something about the history of that particular town. And Lower Beth Horon, and Baalath, and Tamar in the desert. And all the storage towns it talks about, owned by Solomon, all the towns for his chariots and horses, and whatever he was pleased to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the countries under his rule. This is an account of the forced labor for all of that. Now, what's the new one that you've seen in here? You didn't know that he had not just city, but towns where he had his horses and chariots, and he had towns that he had for storage. Okay? Does anybody understand what that means? Does anybody understand what that means? Pony Express. Tell me about the Pony Express. Oh, come on, guys. Some of you were alive then, right? Okay, maybe not. Tell me about the Pony Express. You had a system of carrying the mail when the trains hadn't yet been connected. And so what do? You put some young men on horseback, and they ride as fast as they can, as far as the horses can run. And that's 15, 20 miles, something like that. And then what do? They get off the horses, get on new horses, ride another 20 miles. Get off the horses, get on new horses. Which means what? You've got to have provisions for horses all the way across, right? What did this thing just say? He had towns for his horses and his chariots. What does that mean? Garrison towns where he had the equipment that soldiers would need to pacify and do whatever, and probably soldiers were stationed there. And those would be everywhere. And he had forced labor building those places. What were the storage places?
Probably for grain.
You're starting to reap the harvest, and the people don't get too much of that because the king is taking it off. He's raking it off the table. I was reminded this week that this probably has little to do with this, but I'll tell you the story anyway. We had a dean in the School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Richmond some time ago who had authorized faculty positions with salaries that had not been filled. We were growing. Our department almost doubled in the number of faculty over a very short period of time, over about a decade. Some of those positions were authorized and then weren't actually filled for a couple of years because we were looking to try to find as good a person as we could. If we couldn't find the right person, we'd wait and we'd do it again. He kept that salary and just let it accumulate because he said, the day's going to come that we're not expanding anymore. We're going to need resources. They're going to be hard to find. I'm going to give us, this is his word, a soft landing. I'm going to collect all this. Do it. Okay? He did it all legally. He did it all with the knowledge of the comptroller. But the provost didn't know. The University of Richmond has $1.5 billion in its endowment The dean had 4 million. This is the little lamb outside the palace, if you remember that particular story. Okay? The provost raked $2 million off the table and said, you can't have that much. Pull it off the table. Right? That's what the king is doing. The harvest come up and the king is raking some of it off. And where does he put it? If he puts it all in one place and any of it spoils, then it all spoils. So what does he do? He spreads it out. Part of it spreads out because the horses need some of it. The soldiers need some of it. And so he's got towns where the food are, towns where the horses are. It might be the same town or two towns close together. I don't know. But he's building all of these things. Now, what was the mill of? What was the mill of? That's the. It's capitalized, right? This is a big deal. The answer is almost nobody thinks they know. Yeah, a few people think they know. This is the fortification. But it's not exactly known. It's the fortifications of Jerusalem. Plus, most people think it is the filling in of the valley between the original city of David over on this hill and the Temple Mount over on that hill. And there's archaeological excavations that have shown some of this stuff. So there would be all kinds of fortifications, all kinds of places, again, for soldiers and others to live. All of that was being built.
My note on the Millo says, probably for Solomon's expansion of Jerusalem on the ridge north of David's city.
And it says, who was subject to that forced labor? Verse 20.
Oh.
No, it doesn't say all of those. It does not say all of those. I guarantee you, look close, it doesn't say that. All those who survived out of the wars that almost killed them off. And then it says, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, people, those who were not Israelites, and their descendants still remaining in the country, on whom the Israelites had not been able to enforce the curse of destruction, these Solomon levied as forced laborers. Verse 22, he did not, however, impose forced labor on the Israelites. That turns out to be in question, because if you come to something a few chapters later, it says, oh, and by the way, here's what he did to the people of Judah, here's what he did to the people of Israel, and it looks like forced labor was there. So we don't know exactly how to interpret that last part. But is he treating people the way he'd like to be treated? I don't think so. He's not treated Hiram very well. He's not treated the survivors very well. He's not treated others very well. I need to make one small political point. I don't want it to go any further than this. I just want to say, after World War II, the Marshall Plan in Europe and corresponding things in Japan rebuilt Germany and rebuilt Japan as nations that have a place on the world stage. That kind of thing hardly ever happened in history. When a nation had conquered another nation, especially one that had started the conflict. There's something wonderful about that, and Solomon's nowhere near that. This is not very good. It goes on to say he doesn't impose this on the Israelites, for they were soldiers, his officials, his administrators, his officers, his chariot and cavalry commanders. There were 550 officials in charge of the foreman over Solomon's work who supervised the people employed on the work. Would you keep a close eye on that last sentence? How many people were in charge, the foreman for all this forced labor? 550. There's one of those that you're going to learn about. Have you read the rest of 1 Kings? Do you know already who that? Don't say. But do you already know who that one person is that sort of emerges from that group? Because that's who you want to keep an eye out for. Verse 24 begins the next part of the decline. After Pharaoh's daughter had moved from the city of David up, that implies elevation, to the palace which he had built for her, he then built the Millo. 3 times a year it talks about he offers burnt offerings and sacrifices. This would be big feast days for the people because of what we talked about before. And in that way, he completed the temple. So the temple is now in function in this way. But what are the threads here? The people are being oppressed. The people are being starved, maybe. Worked on all of his projects. That's not the settling in of something stable politically. And I don't think it lines up with, if you keep my commandments and my laws. So there's a conflict coming, and I want you to see that. The last.
The time frame for this?
presumably it's in the last, the years right after the 20 years of all the stuff.
20 years, 30 years?
Verse 10 says 20 years for this. Verse 10 says 20 years for this. Verse 26, 27, and 28, the last verses of chapter 9, tell you about one last thing. He goes into partnership with? Same guy. Goes into partnership with Hiram. To do what? To build a fleet of ships. For what purpose? To go and exploit some other place that they can't get to closely by land. Okay. Why would he partner with Hiram? Hiram's from Tyre, and that doesn't mean anything to you. But this is a nation state just to the north and west along the coast, and we have another name for it, I think. I think this is right. It's called Phoenicia. And Phoenicians were the best sea navigators of that part of the world by far. And he's partnering with Hiram. I can expect that Hiram might be a little bit more careful in terms of how he does these things, but there they go. Verse 27 says, for this fleet, Hiram sent men of his, and what does it say about those men? Experienced sailors, mine says. Okay.
Seamen.
To serve with those in Solomon's service, they went to Ophir. Some of you may have a footnote that says where that is. I unfortunately don't, and I forgot to look it up. And they took on, Hiram had given the king 120 talents of gold back in verse 14. They bring back 420 talents of gold. And they didn't seem to bring it back to Hiram. They brought it back to Solomon, if you notice how it reads. Okay, that's finished. We come to chapter 10. What's the first thing you read in chapter 10? Queen of Sheba. Where's Sheba?
That's Solomon.
Where's Sheba? We think that's modern-day Ethiopia, maybe including Eritrea, which split from Ethiopia sometime back. When the Queen of Sheba heard of Solomon's fame, she came to test him with difficult questions. Yours says odd questions.
Hard.
You know, there's no H when you said that. It came out odd. I swear it did. That's old Virginia, Diane. That's old Virginia. Did you hear odd? Hard. Boy, that's your odd for you to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why is she testing him with difficult, mine says, hard, hers says, questions? What had God promised him in that first visit?
Wisdom.
So she's ready with hard questions.
Mike Kekio, was he a heat shade with my West Hampton?
Yeah, he would. He would. She arrived in Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels laden with spices, and an immense quantity of gold and precious stones. Having reached Solomon, she discussed with him everything she had in mind. And Solomon had, mine says, an answer for all of her questions. I have gotten very careful over about the last decade. When people ask me questions, I say, I don't know if I have an answer, but I have a response. And I want you to think about that for a minute. Having an answer is something, that's a higher bar to cross than having a response. Okay? He had an answer to all of her questions. Not one of them was too, this is why I thought you were saying odd, obscure for the king to answer for her.
It's hard again.
Yeah. Now I want you to start at verse 4 and see if you can count with me for just a minute. Mine starts out, when the queen of Sheba saw. Now I want to know, slowly, what did she see? What's the first thing it says she saw? Mine says how very wise Solomon was. Is there any wording in yours that would bring that out more? She saw all the wisdom that he had. What was number two? Mine says the palace that he had built. Yours says the house. I think the word palace is better. Okay. Number three, is somebody keeping track of this? Somebody holding three fingers up just to keep track? Three. Number three, the food at his table. Can we pause for a minute and quote that proverb that was quoted in the church, in the service this morning? Those of you who were not there, it's very important to hear this. When you sit at the king's table, you better hope. You got to be careful. You need to put a knife to your throat if you're a person of gluttony. Because he may offer delicacies, but they're dangerous. I'm not quoting. I'm paraphrasing. Because I don't remember the exact words and I didn't bring it up here with me. Right? Everybody okay? When she saw the food at his table, how many courses would he have had for his meals? At least seven. Possibly a dozen. Number one, what was it?
Wisdom.
His wisdom. Number two,
palace.
The palace he had built. Number three,
food.
The food. Number four,
seating.
The seating of his officials. Mine says the accommodations for his officials. Number five, mine says the organization of his staff. Okay. Number six, the way they were dressed. Number seven, his cupbearers. Number eight, the burnt offerings which he presented in the temple of the Lord. Mine then says, it left her breathless.
Overwhelmed.
Speechless.
No more spirit.
It left her breathless, but she apparently had enough breath to say something, because it goes on to say, she said to the king, the report I heard in my own country about your wisdom and the handling of your affairs was true then. Until I came and saw it for myself, I did not believe the reports, but clearly I was told less than half. For wisdom and prosperity, you surpass what was reported to me. And then she begins to say things that are wild and wonderful. What's the first thing she says? Isn't it great? How happy must be your wives? That's a plural, right? Plural is a problem. So that's the next phrase. How fortunate your wives are. How fortunate are these courtiers of yours. Judith, how do I pronounce that? Courtiers? Yours just says palace officials. Yours says servant. Okay. How fortunate are these courtiers of yours, continually in attendance on you and having the chance to listen to your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God. I love the way she said this. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has shown you his favor by setting you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's ever-loving love for Israel, he has made you king to administer law and justice. And she presented the king with the same amount of gold that it says Hiram gave Solomon back in verse 14, 120 talents of gold, along with great quantities of spices and precious stones. No such wealth of spices ever came again as those which the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. It's not Solomon and Sheba, it's Sheba and Solomon. Similarly, Hiram's fleet, which brought the gold from Ophir, also brought back great cargoes of a certain kind of timber and precious stones. And that timber was what Solomon had used to make the supports for the temple of the Lord, for the royal palace, for the harps and lyres, for the musicians. No more of this timber has come before or since to this day. King Solomon, in his turn, presented the queen of Sheba with everything that she expressed a wish for, besides those presents which he gave her with a munificence. I love that word. Does yours have that good a word?
Bounty.
Bounty, yours says that's the same thing. With a munificence worthy of King Solomon's. And after that, she went to her own country, she and her servants. And the next few verses, from 14 down to 25, is simply giving you a list of all the stuff that came. Down buried in the middle of this, he had living lions sitting there by his throne. 12 of them, it says. 2 in one place and 12 more further down. So it must have been 14 total. Nothing like it has ever been made or seen in any other kingdom. Verse 23, for riches and wisdom, King Solomon surpassed all the kings on earth. Doesn't this sound great? Doesn't this sound great? The seeds of decay that you heard early are simmering under the surface. They're still there. Verse 26, he built up a force of chariots and cavalry. How many? 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses, and he stationed these in the chariot towns. That's what we talked about before. In Jerusalem, the king made silver as common as rocks, and cedar wood as plentiful as sycamore in the lowlands. He imported his horses from far away. The king's dealers bought them at market price and then brought them back. The chariots were imported from Egypt. Gives you the prices of the horses. Chapter 11 starts to finish it off. King Solomon loved
many foreign women.
Mine has three words there. He loved many foreign women. Not only Pharaoh's daughter, but also who? Women, plural, from Moab. Women, plural, from Edom, from Sidon, from Hittites. From those people of whom the Lord had said to the Israelites, you are not to go among them, nor they among you, or they will be sure to sway your hearts to their own gods. But Solomon was deeply attached to them. He had 700 wives of royal rank. It does not say he had 700 wives. It just says those wives that he had that were of royal rank, there were 700 of them. There could have been more. There could have been more. And it also says he had 300 concubines. And verse 4 says it. When he grew old, his wives did just what God had said. They swayed his heart to other gods. His heart was not holy with the Lord his God as his father David's had been. I'm going to pause there for just a minute. I have a challenge for you. One of the books that we're working on right now, we have worked on 1 and 2 Samuel, and we saw the beginning of the kingdom period, Saul and then David transitioning into Solomon as we came into 1 Kings. What's going to happen in the rest of 1 Kings and all of 2 Kings? We're going to go all the way through the kingdom period as the kingdom split in the north and south, as the northern kingdom is conquered by Assyria, and the sort of half-breeds of Samaria end up in that place in Jesus' time. The southern kingdom finally, some years later, taken away by Babylon. That's the kingdom period, right? How many kings across that period? Starts with L. Lots. That's a whole lot better than trying to name a number. Okay, at the end of almost every account of a king, even if it's short, sometimes it's long, there is a judgment by the historians of the quality of that king. And it sounds like this. They did great for a while, and then it all fell apart. Or they never did good at all. They were just corrupt and rotten from first to finish. If you look... I've got a chart. I'm going to try to make a copy of it and bring it to you. I forgot to do it for today, but we don't quite need it yet. I've got a chart that lists all the kings, and it lists them with three superscripts. One superscript is a capital P. That's the judgment, please the Lord. And there's only a couple of those. There's a squiggle, I think it is, and that means they partly please the Lord. That's what's happening here. And like in football, if you lose it late, that's worse than losing it early and getting it back. And then finally, there's D, which means displease the Lord all the way through. You look at those kings, and your heart just sinks. And I find myself thinking, what does that say about the people we have as leaders today? Would God that they would have a capital P. Would God at least we have a few that have a squiggle. And I'm not making that judgment. I'm just inviting you to take a look. So let's read that verse again. When Solomon grew old, his wife swayed his heart to other gods, and his heart was not holy with the Lord his God, as had his father David's heart been. And then it goes on and gives you the details. Solomon became a follower of Astarte. the goddess of the of Sidon, and of Milcom, who is described as the Ammonite abomination. He did what is displeasing to the Lord, and was not a wholehearted follower of the Lord as his father David had been. Then it was, verse 7 says, that he built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the mountains to the east of Jerusalem, and to Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. He did the same for all of his foreign wives who offered incense and sacrifice to their gods. Most of us are prepared for the idea that worship of God in the temple declined as you go through the kingdom period, and got so bad that that's why God cut it off. Most of us do not have the picture that the decline was not like this. The decline was more like this, falling off a cliff, and it all happened. It all began hugely while Solomon was king. They build the temple, and before the life ends of the man who was in charge of building the temple worship is almost gone, and in its place is all of this. We don't have time to look at this in detail, so if you have something to write on, I want you to write down a couple of references. If you take a look at Genesis 19, verse 30 through 38, God specifically says, watch out for Moab, watch out for Ammon. They are going to sink you if you're not careful. That, again, was a paraphrase, Hal. That's a paraphrase. Watch out for Moab. Watch out for Ammon. What did we just hear? Moab and Ammon. Sidon was also named, but not as strongly as these two. Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 6 talks about this. Leviticus 18, 21 talks about this. Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 6. Leviticus 18, 21. 2 Chronicles 28:3, 2 Chronicles 33:6, 28:3, 33:6. Jeremiah 7, verse 31, Jeremiah 19, verses 2 through 6. Here's what you get. One of these, I don't think it matters too much to line it up with which one. One of these said, we're going to put in temple prostitutes. You want to worship God, you come to church and have sex with prostitutes. The other one put in male prostitutes. Come to church, have sex with prostitutes, off you go. Equal opportunity. The third one took children and threw them into the mouth of an idol where the flames were, and they were burned in the flames. You're talking about sex as worship, and you're talking about child sacrifice. The killing of children. The killing of children. As something that you think you ought to do. I'm going to let that phrase hang, but I should be standing on dangerous ground. The killing of children because you think that's what you ought to do. And it's going to cost Solomon his kingdom almost entirely. What does it say? Verse 9. The Lord was angry with Solomon, and that's where we stop. You've got to read a little bit more to see what else happens.
You know, I don't know if you're referring to this or not, but what they're saying is, if you look at what's taking place today, the abortion...
I don't want to go there, but if you would like to go there after I finish... I'm pointing you there, but I don't want to go there. That takes too much time to even start that, and I don't think I'm competent to deal with that in full. I simply note, child sacrifice, something that you think you ought to do, seems to be at the center of this crumbling and falling apart of the glory that was Solomon's. And I wonder.
The idea that it all started with gluttony.
It all started with gluttony, yeah. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for these words. Some of these are hard, but you're showing us something really important. You have offered to Solomon permanence and eternity if he will follow your laws and your commandments. And he can't do it. He won't do it. And we start to wonder, where does that leave us? And we thank you then for the verses that say, all have sinned and all have come short of the glory of God. But while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Help us be grateful, deeply, permanently grateful for what you have done for us, for there's no way we can do it for ourselves. We thank you for your Son who has made it possible for us to be right with you. And we pray for your guidance, the guidance of your Spirit as we live our lives before you. For we ask all this in your Son's name. Amen.